want to thank you all for being here, and we'll do a little Q&A here. I'm Dave Novak. I'm in the music department and the co-director with Greg Siegel, who's here, of the Center for the Interdisciplinary Studies of Music. And we're happy to be sponsoring this film, and thank you both for coming. And I wanted to start off just by asking you a little bit about your background, since I've noticed that both of you came to Korea, I guess, later in your scholarship. And I wondered also about sort of your punk rock backgrounds, and maybe you could talk about your band and some of the ways that you got involved in the scene. Because there's a couple of different ways you can imagine getting involved in the scene. One might be through an interest in Korean culture, and one might be through this transnational punk rock scene and your own personal backgrounds in the music. Did they kind of come together, or did they come separately? I just wanted to hear about that.
First of all, I wanted to thank you all for coming and taking time out of a beautiful Southern California day to come and watch our film and listen to Stephen B. Smart and me yammer on. I think we have probably slightly different narratives of how we came to Korean studies. I, of course, came through the more traditional route of Scandinavian mythology, which is a fairly well-trod route, and was actually found myself in 1987 working at the National Museum in Korea as part of a Cultural Properties Preservation Bureau National Shaman Certification Squad, which, you are all shaking your head as, oh, yes, of course, why wouldn't you do that? And so at the time, Stephen and I had already been playing in a band in Berkeley. I left the band for the year. Then I think Stephen left the band the next year to also go to Korea. I'm a folklorist originally by training.
What was the band called?
We never had a name.
Yeah,
lots and lots of different names. We never quite could decide on that, which was probably our great downfall. Why you've never heard of us? All those great bands that you can't remember their name. That was us. We were, Stephen plays bass. I own a drum set, and we played that way. I think Stephen at one point in '87 had come and visited me. And was really horrified by the music that was playing at the time. I think I'll let him tell his part of the story later on. He became even more horrified. The first documentary came about, I have a much more sort of apocryphal story about how it came about. He actually has a real story. But I don't know if he called me or if he emailed me, and he basically said, you will not believe what I've found. Because we had been complaining about the lack of, I guess, punk rock or any kind of edgy music in Korea for a very long time. And he told me about Hyundai and Drug, and I think it was within 6 months that we had scraped together some money, and I came over and we started working on the first documentary. So that's how I got into this. Okay. So it really is pretty predictable.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I came through the less predictable method of through classics. I mean, my PhD was in Greek literature. That's what I was doing at Berkeley. But in fact, from early on in my career at Cal, I in fact was already moving towards East Asian studies. I sort of came full circle. I started undergrad doing Chinese, and then for various reasons wound up in classics, and then came back. But had been doing Korean studies, Korean literature in particular, and doing literary translations since the late 80s. But as Tim says, one of the problems in Korea is liking the music that I did. I just had a hard time with what I was hearing ambiently back in the late 80s. There was Korean popular music, obviously, but it is nothing like what we know as K-pop today. And you also had Western, soft Western rock that you would hear, and it was really tough for me. But in the late 90s, when I was back, there was a scene that was starting up in Hyundai in the mid-90s, and a friend of ours, who is also now a Koreanist, Mike Shin, he's a Korean historian at Cambridge, said, hey, Steve, when you're there, you should check out what's happening. You'll find a place, this club, Drive. I think you'll really like the music, and I went, and it was fantastic. So when I first started getting into the scene, in fact, I was just going as a fan. was living well away from that area. So it was something almost of a pilgrimage for me to go to Drug to check it out. But I felt like I had finally found my spiritual home in Korea. And so while I was there, though, and really enjoying the music and some of the bands I was seeing, and in particular Crying Nut in their younger days when they started out, there were nights I was seeing them. And I think I am so lucky because I'm seeing the best band in the whole world at this very moment. But I was thinking, you know, this is so interesting. What is it about what has changed that we have a scene now where 10 years ago in the late 80s, you couldn't even really imagine punk rock in Korea. So I started to just interview people a bit more formally and put together some writing and did some articles. And then I had the idea, like, so I'm like, hey, Tim, let's make a documentary. And that's where the first one came about. And I've been following what's been happening with the scene ever since.
So what do you think did cause the change? That, you know, one thing would be, one thing I can think of is the change in the government.
Yep.
Another thing I can think of is the rise of transnational media industries.
Yeah,
are those the reasons? Or
those are certainly in there. In fact, I cut down my slides. I've got a slightly longer presentation, but one of them is looking at what the factors were that led to the rise of punk rock and the indie scene in Korea in the 90s. So certainly Korea just coming along economically had a lot to do with it. And definitely democratization played a role in a few different ways. One of the things that it really did was to shift the interests of youth. So instead of going to university and having your main social life be around circles that were going out to protest against the government, that more or less evaporated. And there was, into the 90s, still something of a protest culture, but it really had changed. Something else that also played a role is just having clubs to play in. So the government, the military dictatorship, didn't like having young people gathered playing music because of the potential for subversion. So in the early 1990s, you had the rise of sort of live cafes and so on. And in the first documentary, we give some attention to that. So Youth Dollar. And so, yes, transnational media, the rise of the internet in the 90s, and especially later on in the decade, and people being able to get MP3s, liberalization of passport requirements, so people getting out into the world, finding interesting music, bringing it back, sharing it around, that played a role. And one of the things that only later that I picked up on, because I was so focused on the Korean scene, is the late 90s is when you start to get a lot of punk scenes developing all around Asia. And I think one of the major things that was going on is that if you look at what was happening with punk, it was the mid-90s that you start to have the revival with bands like Green Day, who gets mentioned in Rancid and The Offspring and so on. So that's when punk sort of broke at a global level.
Great. Well, the one thing about the title I wanted to ask is, it's called Us and Them, Korean indie rock, right, mm-hmm. in the K-pop world. So one thing I wanted to know is, what does it mean to be independent mm-hmm. in Korea? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of different ways you can go.
Yeah.
With that.
Do you want to?
That was actually one of the motivating factors was was in fact that question: what does it mean to be independent, particularly in the context of the rise of a fairly large corporate presence in the production and distribution of popular music? And we were trying to get at that from a series of different perspectives. I think one of the main bands that we had intended to focus on was the Rock Tigers, and they're very successful, particularly across the Korea-Japan divide. We weren't getting anything that was cohering in any way that could make a compelling story. So I think it means a lot of different things to a lot of different slices of this. I think there are challenges, as Stephen has mentioned, with the rising rates in rents in Hongdae, mm-hmm. the very small bands with small followings are getting forced out of that area. The club spot that Jeff and Trash were managing closed just recently. Mm-hmm. So that was really had become potentially a real locus for you know, the type of indie rock that they play. There's a Stephen knows more about the rise of sort of shoegazer music and some of the new sort of soft indie rock, that when you say indie in Korea, it really means that, not what we were looking at. Mm-hmm. I think each of these bands is trying to figure out a musical environment and a community for themselves. And I think some of them are sort of vertically integrated, some of them are horizontally integrated. But in some ways, they are aware and looking at the corporate superstructure that has taken over so much of the musical landscape. But then you've got someone like Bernie, who's trying to grab at a piece of that musical landscape, or the corporate landscape, for bands like this. And so there, he's actually been very successful in even attracting, I think, government support and other types of investments. Will they ever compete on the level that these big K-pop bands are competing? I can't imagine that they will, but of course, that's also the kind of the point for a lot of anti-establishment musicians, is that that's not what they're going for. So this was the tension that we were trying to get at, I think that's a very hard thing to try and capture in a film, is something that is dialectic by nature and is embedded in some sort of complex series of tensions. You know, docs are best when they have a good, strong, clear storyline. So our storyline starts off strong and clear, and then it kind of gets jumbled, and then it, you know. So we had a hard time finding the storyline here.
One thing I would say, just with the term indie, we struggled, in fact, even with including that in the title, because the first documentary had punk rock, and so a few of the bands are, whatever that means, clearly punk. The Geeks, hardcore. Crying Nut is known as an indie punk band, but they're a rock band. They play all sorts of different genres. Sometimes they even introduce traditional Korean music, or you saw they have the accordion that they're going. And then Third Line Butterfly would be, yes, more indie, and then rockabilly. So these different types of genres of music. One of the things that's kind of interesting that happened, even after we did our filming, is those of you who do follow Korean music will know that there has been kind of a K-indie that is being branded and starting to get out there, which is a bit different from what we focus on, because it is, as Tim said, a kind of a softer sound. There's a lot of, I think of it as quasi-jazzy, bossa nova-influenced, whispery vocals, not terribly challenging in volume and so on. So you do have what you could call K-indie now as well. In some of these bands, I think what's interesting, I suppose, you could say that what is independent, it stands in opposition to the mainstream.
Right.
That's where it comes from. That's how the indie scene really started out and coalesced in Hongdae in the 1990s. But a couple of these indie bands actually have made it on some of the K-pop shows and have gotten to be fairly successful as well. So you have corporate money that is trying to get a hold of this. And actually, I think one of the most interesting things with K-pop over the last few years is the government recognized, from probably the latter part of the 2000s, the last decade, that K-pop is really something that is driving the Korean wave. It's a new renaissance of what's happening. So they're pushing all of these bands. They're like the idol bands, Girls' Generation, and then some of the boy bands, Big Bang, and so on. And then you have the most viral video in the entire history of the planet, comes out of nowhere with no support from the government whatsoever. So when Gangnam Style broke, then it's like, wow, you know, we've got all of this creativity that is existing here, and so how can we foster this? So the Rock Tigers got some government support to do things. So Bernie has been leading a lot of these bands on tours to South by Southwest, making it down to Austin, Texas, as he referred to, calling it Soul Sonic, so S-E-O-U-L, and branding it. as coming from Korea, and there's been more and more support from COCA, the Korean Overseas Cultural Contents Agency. Yeah, that's what it stands for. And so they gave a lot of support for these indie bands to go in 2015. So when you're getting that kind of government support, I think it also raises the question, are you still indie? Now, even the punk bands, even when they were being rebellious, they weren't singing songs against the Korean government in particular. It was about being rebellious, say, stuff against the education system. But everybody in Korea, I think you can be legitimately pro-government and have your beefs with the education system, or people singing about problems with parents as well. But there's very little of the, you know, anarchy in the ROK, you know, that sort of stuff doesn't exist so much.
Well, one of the things that I think creates the context for independent music is this dialectic, like you were saying, between mainstream and underground. And it's really hard for that to exist anymore in the United States. Mm. So when I look at the germination of this kind of a scene and in some of the tensions you're talking about, this massive K-pop industry and then this tiny underground, where people really don't have very many resources for doing it themselves, whereas a lot of the mainstream industry in the United States is now doing it yourself, and maybe on different scales. Mm. And here it seems like there is a little bit, despite this government intervention you're talking about, where this underground mainstream tension is retained, and so it creates the possibility for this punk discourse to arise, where it maybe doesn't have the same kind of soil to grow in anymore in the United States or the UK, places where you might have seen
it. I think lies at the basis of one of our discussions about this compilation. I think the compilation really becomes a driving factor there, because what you're looking at really is a DIY compilation. It's got a little bit more facilities behind it than just kids in their basement, but only marginally. I mean, they've got they've got Pro Tools on a Macintosh running there in the back, and that's about it, and some nice microphones. But it really is not a professional product. But in some ways, that's really what they were trying to capture there as well. It really is a DIY kind of thing. So that's one of the things that drew us to that compilation as well.
But it is interesting that just even DIY, the ability to make something more professional now in 2015 compared to 20 years ago, instead of the four-track crappy recording, you can do a pretty reasonable job. And then with so many Korean bands, and you can just get on YouTube and just make your own discoveries, and that now there is the platform that exists for these people readily to get their music heard around the world. So that also...
So that must have been a pretty big difference between your first film in 2001 and nowadays. Do Korean bands feel that they're connected to a transnational scene in a way that they weren't before?
Definitely.
And is that because, I imagine that the opportunities to tour, have they increased? And so that there's more of a buy-in from transnational audiences, like they were talking about Sweden.
Yeah, yeah. It used to be a big deal to get over to go to Sweden or to go to somewhere in like Singapore. Mm-hmm. But now it's become fairly commonplace, and that's really this decade. In the 90s, nobody was talking about going overseas. Occasionally people going to Japan. In the mid-2000s, you had, say, the Korea-Japan Oi Festival. So skinheads that were closely connected between Korea and Japan. As Tim mentioned, the Rock Tigers. There's a big rockabilly scene in Japan, as you're probably aware. Not as big, the Rock Tigers and a couple of other bands in Korea, but they've tried to do the Rock Tigers did these kimchi billy nights once a month, where they would try to bring over at least one band from Japan. And Gina, who is actually a very good linguist, it's interesting, one of the things also with the sense of transnationality, the first documentary, we had a few Korean Americans who were speaking in English.
Two.
But now, two. But there was some English, whereas this time what you're getting the sense is the language is getting all mixed up. And I really like Song Yi-won, his language is so code switching. Just a few words in English and then Korean and back and forth. Gina actually speaks good English, but she spoke only Korean. She also speaks excellent. Her English is good. Her Japanese is very fluent. So, and they've gone over there a bit.
So an interesting point early in the film is Hyung Jun Shin, who mm-hmm. says that even the, I think he's talking mm-hmm. about the kimchi billy scene, yeah. or about, you know, and he says something like, "It's still Korean to me."
Yeah.
And I wondered what he meant by that.
We do too. This question came up the other day.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why I cut to that performance, because I was hoping that maybe actually somebody watching it would say, "Oh yes, of course, that's quite Korean." But
well. Yeah, I've got to ask Hyunjin the next time I see him if he can reconstruct, because what happened in the filming, we were filming outside and then a motorcycle went by, so it's got... and then these are the things that happen when you're doing a documentary, so we can try and project what he might have meant, but I don't
well,
know.
One of the things that I see in the transnational circulation of underground scenes is people looking for some sort of local flavor, and even naming something kimchi billy is a mm-hmm. way of sort mm-hmm. of claiming that essentialism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, you said that sometimes Crying Nut does traditional Korean songs. I mean, is there a way of mediating a Korean identity here in a way that might make it appealing to people who might otherwise see the Korean scene as just imitation of what was happening in the United States 20 years ago?
I think that a lot of, well, certainly the Chosun punk, you know, initially, they're really trying to put that stamp on the scene, partly as a selling point. So even this, I call it Special K, K-pop, yeah. K-indie, K-food, you know, showing up to brand things. It's almost a way of trying to mark out the national identity. But one of the great questions around K-pop is, what is Korean around in K-pop? And one of the things that is Korean about it, as I suppose a lot of times when people talk about what is Japanese about it, it's right. the way that these influences from all around the world are resynthesized in a particular way. And I think you get something of that. And increasingly there are a lot of bands that... what is Korean about it? And if you take especially Kimchi Billy, okay, that's very playful, mm-hmm. but it's taking rockabilly. There could hardly be a more quintessentially American genre than rockabilly. So I don't know what Hyunjin would say to this, but is there anything other than the fact that these people are ethnically Korean to it? I don't know. And what I am thinking about and what I was suggesting in my intro talk, that I'm really wondering, as we have people just crossing the globe and moving back and forth, and you have non-Koreans in the Korean scene, to what extent are we going to even be able to talk of it as a Korean scene, you know, a national scene?
Sometimes the question is, to what extent can we avoid talking about it that way?
Yeah.
Because so much of the authority of the music circulation has to do with it, mm-hmm. with those things, you know, that it comes from Korea, the punks in Korea. And then what did he say about the people at Gilman Street? Well, they said, we didn't even know this existed in Korea. They weren't saying, what a great band we've got to listen to, necessarily. Mm. So a lot of that is about, you know, sort of the circulation. It what's special about it is the fact that it can conjoin all these different scenes, like Gilman Street and these Korean Americans, and then Koreans in Korea, and all these disparate audiences with the different backgrounds can feel part of it.
I guess what would be interesting, and who knows, in 25, 40 years, it's the way in the U.S. you would have an Athens, Georgia, Minneapolis, Seattle scene, and we're going to be talking about, say, a soul scene. And actually, one of the places, oddly, where hardcore has been established is in Cheongju, so a provincial city for whatever reason. It's like all it takes to make a scene sometimes is you get three or four really good bands who happen to be in the same place at the same time, and then people who want to market it or say, you know, there's a whatever scene. So then,
as we all know from the American scene and the hardcore scene in the 80s. Mm. Well, before we go too far in our K-hole, I want to open up the conversation to people who are in the audience who might have questions, you know, and not dominate it entirely with my own interest. So does anyone have a question for the directors? Yeah.
Jarvis. Thanks so much. This was really interesting. As somebody who does Japanese studies, every time I see something about Korea, I guess it's like so new, but also not that different, but also pretty it's fascinating. I was just wondering if you could say a little more about the transformation of Hongdae in terms of, if I got it right from the film, the government wanted to kind of create it into an entertainment district, and that ruined it. but we're not ruined, but it changed dramatically. So I'm just curious, were they trying to sort of prop up and support this punk thing, or were they trying to get rid of it to create something new? I've seen Courage of Blue Train pretty dramatically in the last 10 years, and I don't know if that's government or what that is.
So that would be an interesting one to compare it to. I think it's a very similar process, that what you have, I don't think that it's the government, it's more they're following along what's happening in larger commercial processes. So they see that this is growing, it's getting bigger, and it's like, well, let's give it a bigger infusion of funding, let's spruce up the area. Oh, this is a place people are coming, let's make it, you know, nice. But right. Their idea of nice is moves it away from something that has an
that was attracting people in the first place. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have a couple.
It still has the big driver of the university right there, which is a big art school, and so that's driving a lot of the foot traffic. So it's kind of an interesting thing there, where you have an art school and a scene around the art school, and then you prop it up with certain government infusion, and yet you still have the art school there. So
I'm curious about the relationship between the bands and the genres of music, and sort of any question of working class culture or middle class culture. There was one of the musicians mentioned work, and I was really curious. Well, what does he do? And like, is it a sort of a middle class job for his age group, or is he talking more like a working class kid? Or how does that work?
We addressed that more in the previous documentary, in one of the articles that I've written. I would say a lot of the people who were in the scene, the early scene, and as you look at a lot of punk scenes there, it's not that Britain working class roots. A lot of these people are more middle class or upper middle class kids. And a lot of the early indie people were students at Seoul National University, top university in Korea. And with actually Gisop from the Geeks, who's his job, he went to the Korean University of Foreign Studies, so a good university. He's a manager at GM Daewoo. He's actually a middle manager. He's got a very good kind of corporate job, and that makes him an interesting figure. As he says, he was a good student. And some of the other people, you know, they've been through university. It varies. The guys in the Rock Tigers, a lot of them are music teachers, and that's how they're making a living. Jeff is now, he's got an MA, so he's teaching English at a university. So I think he likes to refer to himself as an assistant professor. I think that's what is on his Facebook page. I don't know. But some of the, a lot of the people in the scene do have reasonable educations. But there have been a couple of bands who had more working class roots.
I think it's very interesting that it's the middle class, and that it's middle class youth, because quite frankly the majority of kids at this point in Korea are middle class youth, and we tend as anthropologists or as ethnologists to overlook the middle class, which is actually a very important area to spend a lot more attention focusing on. So we did get some criticism of, why aren't you looking at the working class youth? Well, because we're looking at, in some ways, that wasn't the driver. It wasn't, we weren't being driven by a class consciousness. We were being driven by looking at the punk rock scene. That it sussed out that most of these kids were middle class, I think that's fine. And I think it's actually a very interesting segment of the Korean population to explore.
But there are some interesting things going on with that I think about. Say, looking back to the first documentary, actually one of the bands that seemed to have a bit more of that were trying to suggest they were working class. One of them, the previous documentary ends with a guitar smash, you know, just like guys really angry. The most impressive guitar smash I've seen ever in all of my attending music shows. But he was back the next week with a new guitar. So that was interesting. Rux, the band that gets mentioned, And Jonghee, the leader of that, has a lot of cred as kind of authentic punk, but he's from Cheongdam-dong in Korea. People know Korea. So he's from a very wealthy area as well. But what I would say, and what might be interesting, is, again, thinking about where Korean society is, and we can say, yeah, the people are middle class, but youth unemployment in Korea is really getting out of control. And there's a phrase, the Pashipaman one, the generation now, what they're able to earn in a month is just not really keeping pace. So there may be more disaffected youth who have anger that they want to burn off. I don't know. You know, we might see that.
I actually kind of makes me rather curious too, because usually middle to upper middle class families don't really in front of their kids going into things like this. Like, I'm from a Chinese family, but I also had a really good friend back in middle school who's from a very staunch Korean family, and she wanted to get into this stuff. Her parents were just like, no, she's from a middle class family. And then my best friend went to Korea to teach English, and she would constantly talk about how almost sort of railroad, like sometimes the feel of railroad track, like sometimes the feel of the social structures that would go on there. And to hear that these guys are from upper middle class families, it is a pleasant surprise, you know, because that tells me that whatever truth there is to point of view, the social structural one, that the social structure is rather rigid and the expectations are extremely rigid as well, does not stop this sort of flower of creativity that exists there. And especially in regards to the sort of archetype that most people have of artists that come from Korea, most of them being K-pop artists who are trained, yes indeed, for like 6 to 7 years before they are released to the public and have very like restricted sense of creativity.
In the first talk, there was an all-female punk band that we followed, and they were really fascinating. And we asked them actually how their parents reacted to it, and it was a broad range of answers from the "my parents really don't like this at all," and she seemed really worried about that, and to the other ones, one said, "Oh, my parents were really supportive of it, just go and do it," and another one said, "Oh, my parents are kind of funny about it, they don't really quite understand it, but they, you know, they don't prevent me from doing it." So there was a broad range of responses, and I think that was something that we were pleased and about capturing, and really we thought we made that a pretty important part of the previous doc. I think this idea of children rebelling against the parents and also these social structures, it started to get challenged actually on a nationwide basis with the IMF financial crisis, where people who thought they had long-term stable jobs were leaving the house in the morning pretending that they were going to the long-term stable job, but they were unemployed, and they were going and hanging out at the PC Bang and things like that.
One of the other things, just thinking about class and youth, is if you notice, the people in this documentary, and as we said, some of the same people are still in the scene today. The first documentary, we were focusing, most of the people were late teens, early 20s. A lot of the people now in their 30s or even in their 40s. So that's actually an interesting shift that is going on. And a lot of, where's a lot of the youth, the young energy? The number of aspirants for K-pop is just through the roof. I mean, you still have people who might want to be more challenging the mainstream or have other ideas of what they want to do with their music, but there has been a shift. So that some of this stuff, like punk or heavy metal, somebody was asking me about heavy metal earlier. Now, I'd be interested if, in fact, there probably are heavy metal bands forming now among young people in Korea, but I don't know of it, and I associate heavy metal with, like, guys who are our age, you know?
So I think we have time for one more, and then we'll play it.
Talking about age, I wanted to ask a question about the audience. You know, in Japan, I've been to rockabilly clubs, and they're all middle-aged folks like me, dancing and twisting, and I'm wondering, do we have that kind of scene in Korea? Could you introduce me to a club? And then, I love rockabilly clubs in Japan. And then secondly, one of the your interviewees, you kind of have an ambivalence. They said, oh, if Sonya Shide or Girls' Generation called us, we would love to join them. So has anyone tried to make them, you know, hire a professional makeup artist, stylist, or choreographer to make them more marketable?
Well, as I said, when Rock Tiger got an infusion of funds, then they did this very slick video, and I don't know whether it was what they wanted or what they were just told, do it this way, but it's completely out of character for them. I think what Song Yuan is saying, if it's not if Sonya Shide calls us, it's like if they can open the door, like if they can break it, Korean music into the globe, around the globe, and then we can follow, that would be great.
Yeah, but to have all this kind of stylist and makeup people, plastic surgery, all of these K-pop people.
I think his thought was if then indie music can follow it on its own terms more is what he wanted. I know the rockabilly clubs, because we followed, it doesn't really make it into the documentary, but it went with the Rock Tigers on a tour to Japan and went to a few shows. And there were people of every decade of life, and it was just a wonderful thing to see. There was some like six-month-old baby, seven-year-old, 15, all the way to, you know, up to 70-year-olds. Yeah, yeah. It wouldn't be surprised if some of the people were into their 80s, you know, up into the upper 70s. In Korea, there's much more stratification around age. That said, as with going to indie shows in the U.S., which has really changed, thinking over 30 years ago, I guess, as people have grown old with it, that now you can get a variation. And if you were to go to see one of these bands in Korea now, or go to see a ska show, I think you would find people in their 20s, 30s, 40s.
The big Crying Nut show that we filmed had people all the way up to their 70s.
Well, that
the Crying
Nut,
of course,
yeah,
is also,
that was an outdoor
Crying Nut is also very slick. They do have stylists and, you know, costume people and all of that kind of stuff, so...
Widen the, you know, the audience generations, isn't it?
It's not. Yeah, it might be. It's not entirely clear. It depends on what their success criteria are.
Yeah, what you want to do.
What do you want to do?
I mean, the folk rock scene I grew up with is coming back. Remember the sexual group formed again? They're on tour, and there was a movie made about their life. And the audience is all middle-aged like me and older. And they are completely nostalgic and willing to pay a lot of money to go to their concerts. Mm. So there's been a folk rock revival from the 70s in 2014. Mm. So do you see anything like that happening? But since there was no punk rock scene established in the first place, it's not going to revive.
Yeah, you wouldn't have something like a revival for punk. But there's a broadening of the ages of people who show up, definitely compared to the drug days.
The drug days.
Yeah, back in the 90s. Yeah. You would have, that was kind of interesting because you'd have people come in their high school uniforms back then.
To a club called Drug.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was an interesting issue, you know, where the name, they say it hadn't, you know, and it would be hard in Korea to really be open about Drug. And they were saying, no, it's to suggest just throwing off of constraints. And to be, I must say that in Korea, I've certainly never at any show in all these years seen anybody within the scene who seemed to be on anything more than soju and cigarettes.
So. Well, maybe that's enough.
Yeah.
All right, well, I want to thank you both for coming, Stephen and Timothy, and we really appreciate
it. Thank you so much.